Today, in this second hour of the show, we'll be having another conversation about the future of the university and its changing role. And we are taking advantage of a series of talks on the campus that are exploring the same territory. These are sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study. There have been four so far, and it's a series that will continue throughout the next few months. And I'm sure that we'll have many of the speakers here on the program so we can bring some of these issues to a wider audience. I would expect that those most interested in this would be people here on the campus and perhaps at other campuses where people listen. But I think it's well, there's a reason for people who are not associated with the university to think about these things too and perhaps being exposed to the ideas. And so we thought maybe it'd be a good idea to have some discussion of these issues. And we're pleased here to have with us this morning Donald Langenberg. He is a physicist by academic training. He's well known as an advocate of higher education. He is the chancellor of the 13-member University System of Maryland and has had that post since 1990. Before that, for about 7.5 years, he served as chancellor of the University of Illinois at Chicago. He also has been acting director and deputy director of the National Science Foundation and professor of physics at University of Pennsylvania. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Illini Union, room 210. So anyone who's interested certainly should feel welcome. And as we talk, questions are also welcome. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, also toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, David.
As someone who's been involved in higher education for some years, I wonder, as you think about what the important questions were when you started, say when you got your PhD or when you got your first post as professor, how things have changed. What's the difference between now, 2001, and then?
Obviously, the thing that was most on my mind when I got my PhD was what kind of a career was I going to pursue? It turned out to be in universities. I was dedicated to research and to teaching. That's about as far as I thought for a long time. That began in 1960. That was 40 years ago, and I have watched some very substantial changes in universities. Then the Cold War was still on. And in my field, in physics and in other related fields, we were seeking greater federal funding for our work. One of our arguments was that it was important to the national security and the national defense. The Cold War is over. And today we are still seeking greater federal funding. Our arguments now tend to be we have become critical to the future vitality of our society and of our nation. That's so because we educate and train the nation's workforce, which increasingly must be highly skilled, highly knowledgeable to support the economy that's evolving in this country. We are educating and training increasingly higher proportions of our population. It's estimated that probably, well, now let me just say, in Maryland, something like 60-70% of all high school graduates now announce an intention to go on to post-secondary education of some kind. So we're gradually approaching an era of near universal college enrollment. So we think we're important. We claim we're critical. And you know what? Our leaders, our political leaders, our social leaders, our business leaders have bought the argument. They got it. They want pieces of our action. They want us to be much more engaged with them than we have been in the past. And with that comes all kinds of tensions and pressures on our institutions of higher education, essentially a new version of the conflict, the longstanding conflict between the notion of a university as an ivory tower, isolated from, separated by purpose from a society at large, to one that is intimately engaged with society, with all that means, both good and bad.
Well, that strikes me that this gets at a very significant issue and probably will be more significant as we have more and more people going to college, and that is, what sort of university do we need can one be full service? What sort of university is best for individual students based on what it is they're looking for? And I think that at major research universities like this one, there has been something of a tension between the feeling on the one hand that we wanted to be a university in an almost medieval mode, where the pursuit of knowledge was the thing, that being one sort of idea. The other idea being that we were a trade school, essentially, at a very high level, but that we were training people for to go out and have careers. And that it seems that we want to be both, and at the same time, we don't.
I think that's exactly right. That tension's been there since the 19th century, in which a couple of very important new ideas evolved. The first was the invention of the research university. The medieval universities preserved classical knowledge and transmitted it to the young. They didn't create new knowledge. And that notion that a university's task also included in creating new knowledge was a new one in the early 19th century. And the second great idea was the land-grant university, the additional notion that a university had a responsibility, if you will, to take that new knowledge and participate actively in moving it into, as the Morrill Act put it, agriculture and the mechanic arts. That is to say, the work of the nation. Well, you can't do that unless you deal directly with the work and the workers of the nation, the industries, the governmental entities. And that gets you involved in a really complicated and oftentimes difficult set of relationships, which run almost directly counter to the notion that a university is a place where knowledge should be pursued for its own sake, and to the maximum extent possible, it should be isolated from the pressures, threats, dangers, and difficulties of what sometimes is called the real world. Mm-hmm. That tension's been around since the 19th century. It's increasing now. It's increasing in part because the notion of student is rapidly changing. We are now expecting that probably most American adults will continue sporadically in higher education throughout their entire working lives. We have one institution in the university system of Maryland whose average student age is about 35. They're working adults, and that institution's enrollment is increasing exponentially. So these long-ago tensions are still there, but they're changing in scale, they're changing in magnitude, and they're changing in character.
Mm. Well, does that lead people who teach and who are at administration, these kind of universities, to think in new ways about what they do? And in fact, I guess perhaps move away from the notion that there's something wrong with teaching, or feeling that, yes, teaching is something that we do, it's necessary, but it's not the most important thing that we do.
I think, among other things, there is an increasing movement toward the notion that teaching is central. Teaching is crucial. Whether in higher education or in the elementary and secondary schools, and with that goes the notion that higher education is directly responsible for the quality of what goes on in the elementary and secondary schools and for the performance of the teachers and of the students in those schools. It is, again, a tightening relationship that brings with it all kinds of complications and worries, but it's one that I think is inevitable and indeed crucial for the future of the country. Teaching is or ought to be king at all levels.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Donald Langenberg. He's the chancellor of the University System of Maryland and has had that post since 1990. Before that, he was chancellor of University of Illinois at Chicago. He's also been acting director and deputy director of the National Science Foundation and professor of physics at University of Pennsylvania, and indeed his academic training is in physics. He's here to talk about the future of the university as part of a series that's been going on and will continue in the months ahead, looking at the university's changing role. It's sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study. So if you're here on the campus and if you're interested, you can hear him later on today at 4 o'clock at the Illini Union. But here, we're also exploring some of the same territory, and your questions are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-WILL. The kinds of things we've been talking about, the tensions and mm-hmm. the concerns, are not for people who are in higher education are not new. You say that they have greater urgency now.
Yes.
And I guess I'm just it certainly seems to be something that we are becoming increasingly aware of, and perhaps now there is an awareness outside of the academy that these issues are there and are being. Mm-hmm. discussed. Are there, in fact, people on the campus that in the past they would have said this wasn't their concern or that it wasn't just that urgent that, in fact, now are bound up on it, bound up in it?
Oh, I think that's true, and I suspect it's true for a couple of reasons. The one is that the interactions between a university and the outside world are becoming so varied that sooner or later, they will directly affect just about everybody on the campus. And the other is, I think, a growing understanding that all this really is happening, mm-hmm. that it is not avoidable, it's certainly not preventable, and that we've just got to get in there and pitch to make it work just as well as it possibly can. And that's everybody's responsibility.
Mm. We have callers. Let's start with Champagne, line number one. Hello. The caller there, line, pardon me, I guess this would be Urbana, line number one.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question. When people, when faculty is hired at a research university, usually the faculty is hired with respect to their reputation as a researcher, not so much as a teacher. So I was wondering if this is something that's going to change in the future or not.
I sure hope it does change. A word or two about that. There's an interesting new report out done by a dozen and a half or so leading universities. It's about the state of research doctoral education in our universities, and it makes clear that the state of doctoral research education in our universities from the point of view of the students, the graduate students and the recent graduate students, is perhaps best and most kindly described as dysfunctional. That is to say, the focus is on research. The focus is on training graduate students for academic careers as researchers, and the students report that that's going wonderfully. They're very pleased with that. But they also report that little is done to prepare them for the teaching side of an academic career. There's nothing new about that. That was true when I became an assistant professor. Nobody ever told me that there was an art to teaching or that there was a science to teaching and that maybe I needed to know something about both of those. They simply turned me loose in the classroom and I taught the way I had been taught, thinking perhaps that was the only way one could teach. The students also report that they are not prepared for that other important part of an academic career, and that is what I will call shared governance, the participation by faculty in the actual guidance and leadership of the institution. Then there's another group of students, those, and it's not a small number, in many fields it's more than half, most fields it's almost half, who do not go into academic careers. They go into industry, they go into government, and they report that there's almost no preparation in graduate school to prepare them to do the kinds of jobs that they'll be expected to do there.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that people should be hired on account of their reputation as a researcher, and then they should improve their skills as teachers, or should the people should be hired as a on account also of their reputation as teachers. I mean, the argument that people usually make against this would be that afterwards there's a fear that the reputation of the faculty as research faculty will go down.
Well, it depends very much on the institution. Any major research university like the University of Illinois must and will continue to hire its faculty with heavy weight on the expectation of the research excellence of the faculty member in question.
So that would be the number one priority.
Well, I really would rather not say this is one, that's two, and that's three.
Mm-hmm.
Because faculty members do have a huge responsibility for the education of the coming generations. And that needs to be done with all of the professionalism, skill, and knowledge that the research is done. The major research universities, however, constitute perhaps 5% of all of American institutions of post-secondary education. The other 95% emphasize teaching, and there it's very clear that when you hire faculty, you do so with the expectation they are going to be superb teachers, not necessarily superb researchers.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. If one acknowledges the fact that we have people who are getting PhDs in whatever their discipline is, going out and becoming professors, spending part of their time teaching, and feeling that they were not prepared for that, then does that mean that colleges and universities are going to institute some sort of requirement that says if your expectation is you're going to become a college professor, there are some courses that you must take? And if that, then how are you going to do that? You're going to create a course, College Teaching 400. Is it going to be in the College of Education? Are you going to require each department to do their own? If you're going to mandate that, how do you meet that need?
I don't know. Many institutions do have organizations or programs to help their graduate students who do expect to go into academe learn something about the teaching profession. Some do it with special institutes or offices. Some simply do it within academic departments. I don't know what the best way to do it is, but I am convinced that we're going to be seeing more of that in the future, simply because we owe it to our graduate students to give them some knowledge of what they're getting themselves into.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. This is Clay City, and the caller's on line number 4. Hello.
Yes, my wife is a school teacher. She works all day long. She has no time to go to school during the day. And they have, Southern Illinois University has put together a program so she can earn a master's degree in computer science. It's weekends and weekdays. She's going to spend two summers on campus for about 2 weeks each.
Mm-hmm.
There's no infrastructure money going to maintain buildings. There's no money going for that, for those facilities. I mean, she's not spending her money at school. How's that affecting the university? And the other thing is, I work in a power plant where we have engineers, and those engineers start out as engineers. But if they want to move up the ladder, if they want to make progress in the field that they're in, they inevitably get into supervision. Now, some of these people that I work for are excellent engineers. They know a great deal about engineering, but they've never been taught how to have people skills, how to deal with people, how to get something done with people. You've touched a little bit on this on the academic side, but there's an industrial side to this too. I mean, you have to have people skills to deal with in these jobs. What are they teaching these kids in school about people skills? And the other thing I was wondering about now is, what's the correlation between education and a career? How closely does the university look at what demand there is in a field and teach for those fields? I mean, I'm saying there's some fields that they teach too many people that end up never using those skills and never going into careers because there's no demand for them. I'll hang up and let you talk on the subject.
Okay.
Let me deal with your third question first, and that goes to the question of how closely do universities stay in touch with the market, if I may call it that, for their graduates? The answer is not closely enough. I think you're quite correct. But part of the answer also is that more universities are getting more and more involved with the notion that they need to try to shape their programs to provide training and education for the students to do what they're actually going to do when they leave. Which takes me to your first couple of questions. You mentioned, what are the universities teaching the kids? Let me ask you to drop the notion of kids. We are moving into a world in which, as I said earlier, most working adults are going to have to come back to some kind of post-secondary education quite regularly during their working careers. The president of the National Academy of Engineering has been saying recently that the half-life of a first-class engineering education, of the kind that you get here at the University of Illinois, is about 5 years. And that is to say, if you go out and practice engineering for 5 years, you've lost about half of what you need to do your job, or you don't have half of what you need to do your job, for example, manage, administer, people skills. And the result is that more and more of our population is going to be in school. Now, they're also going to be working and raising families, like your wife. So many institutions are moving into a huge new market in higher education, sometimes called adult education, continuing education, increasingly technologically enhanced education, web-based degree programs, and the like. And that market is booming. You suggested that there are no bricks-and-mortar expenditures associated with that. There are large expenditures associated with that that don't include bricks and mortar. One of the debates that's been going on is whether or not this new world of education, education for working adults, is going to be cheaper or more expensive than traditional on-campus education. And the answers are not all in yet, but roughly speaking, it's pretty clear the answer is it probably costs about the same. What you don't spend on bricks and mortar, you spend on very sophisticated information technology systems to make it possible.
I hope that gets to the caller's questions, and certainly he's welcome to follow up, and others are welcome to call 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And again, our guest, by the way, is Don Langenberg. He's chancellor of the 13-member University System of Maryland and is here to talk about the university's changing role today on the U of I campus. Again, our numbers here for folks in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess I find myself continuing to think about the many different roles that the university is going to play, different needs that different students will have, and wondering about the idea of the full-service university, whether in fact one institution or many there would be many institutions that can serve all those needs, or are we really looking at a time when there will be many different kinds of universities with different emphasis?
I think it's the latter. American higher education is already enormously diverse. Mm-hmm. We tend to think in terms of large research universities like the University of Illinois. But remember, there are 1,000 or more community colleges. There are many, many so-called comprehensive universities that don't have doctoral research programs, but that educate a very large fraction of our students. There are small liberal arts colleges, some public, some private. It's an enormously diverse system with different institutions doing different jobs. It's going to get more diverse. There are 3,600, roughly, traditional higher education institutions in the country. There are now well over 1,000 corporate universities that began as employee training institutions but are moving well beyond that. And as is well known, there are a number of new entrepreneurial for-profit institutions moving into that adult education market. As an example, I would note an interesting article recently in a journal called University Business, in which they examined this phenomenon, and they sent a reporter to Chicago to visit, study five major, very different universities. I'll give you a moment to think who those five must have been, and then I'll tell you who they were. There was the University of Chicago, the University of Illinois at Chicago, Hamburger U, McDonald's corporate university, the DeVry Institute, which is functioning not only in Illinois, but now in Maryland and many other places around the country, and the brand new outfit called Cardion. That's only five, but that's a reasonable depiction of the kind of diversity that is appearing in the higher education scene, and we're going to see more of that.
Right. Let's go to someone on a cell phone, line number four. Hello.
Yes, I was... I'm kind of concerned a little bit about the university teaching aspect, is that there's the first 2 years off and there are graduate students who are not trained in teaching, perhaps not as efficient in knowledge as some of the full-time professors. And then at the same time, when you have professors who are majorly focused on research, the whole teaching aspect seems to be so weak at times that don't you think this should be a instrumental part of being a graduate assistant, or teaching, and a professorship? And I'll let you go with that. Thank you.
All right. I think in part we've addressed that, but maybe you can talk about it some more.
Well, that's a clear argument, I think, for what many institutions are doing, and that is making sure their graduate students actually know how to teach, the teaching assistants. And I would point out, by the way, that there are some things that you must learn by doing, at least in part, and teaching is one of them, and that's one of the functions of being a teaching assistant in a major research university. It's a little bit like medical residents. And yes, indeed, a lot of people who go to hospitals in our country are treated by medical residents who are, in effect, very senior students learning their jobs. But there is, I would say, a majority of universities in this, research universities in this country, that are paying very close attention to this issue of how you maximize the quality of the undergraduate experience, even in the first couple of years, with senior faculty being very attentive to how those courses are designed and taught, participating in teaching them. I don't expect a day to arrive very soon in major research universities when teaching assistants are nowhere to be seen in those courses. But all around the country, people are paying more attention, and I think things are getting better in that respect.
Let's talk with someone in Champaign here. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
On this question of teaching assistants, I suppose you know that one of the latest uproars in the university is about unionization of teaching assistants and that kind of thing. But it reminds me that a few years back, and I can't remember how long ago, the Carnegie Foundation issued a report on higher education in which it said that universities should do something to shorten the length of time that people are graduate students. Now, we have people here who are graduate students in certain departments that have been here for 15, 10, 15, sometimes 20 years as graduate students. And it seems reasonable that if these people are working as teaching assistants and have kids in high school and stuff, naturally they want a better wage and better conditions and so on and so forth. But I wonder why this proposal of the Carnegie Foundation was never taken up. In other words, there's no reason why a graduate education has to go on for 10, 15, or 20 years. Medical education is a four-year program. People go through it in 4 years, and then they go on to practice their profession. So this question of people being around for years and years seems to me to be a serious problem that the universities really haven't addressed. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with you in part. There are many reasons for that, I believe. And the situation, incidentally, is probably not quite as bad as you described. The time to degree has been gradually lengthening, but there undoubtedly are a few graduate students around who are getting close to being eligible for Social Security payments. But for the most part, it's taking somewhere in the range of 6 to 7 years, typically. Part of that, I believe, is because particularly in the sciences, in engineering, the fields have just become enormously complex. You can see the same phenomenon going on in medicine. It is true that people get MD degrees in 4 years, but most physicians then go on to residencies, which may last for 1, 2, in some cases 4 or 5 years, and their educations really extend to times that are well beyond those of most graduate students. The same kind of thing is beginning to happen in other health-related professions, pharmacy, for example. Undergraduate degrees, baccalaureates in pharmacy, were common in the past. Most pharmacy schools have now switched to the PharmD degree, which is 6 years, and often is followed by some kind of residency kind of requirement. So that's one reason. I would agree that many institutions are, and many graduate students, are not sufficiently attentive to getting on with it and getting out. And I think there do need to be some changes in behavior on the part of all concerned there.
Well, and yes, and of course I agree with everything you said, but there is one other factor, and that is that in some of these fields, people are drawing out their years as teaching assistants because if they're in a field like history or philosophy or English, they may be facing unemployment or a poor level of employment somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so they say, well, you know, I'll just keep on with this. So it suggests that maybe the universities haven't done a good enough job of adjusting the number of graduate students they have to the kind of job opportunities that there are. So, you know, the heartlessness that graduate students complain about universities not coming up with enough money may be only one kind of heartlessness that actually exists. The real heartlessness is not making an adjustment to the job market in some fields, it seems to me.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I would go a little bit beyond and say I don't think the evidence suggests that we haven't done a good enough job of being attentive to the realities of the job market for our graduates. I think it clearly indicates that.
Right. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. I would like to return for the moment to the issue of organizing graduate students. Mm-hmm. Here on this campus, as you know, I'm sure, the graduate students believe that they have the right to organize. They say that they are employees. They point out to the university the fact that the university is saving considerable money by having them teach, and that helps keep down costs. The university argues that the graduate students are students, and as you suggest in some of your comments earlier, the time they spend as teachers is part of their training. That is, they're learning mm-hmm. how to be teachers. I guess I wonder whether you think that this kind of argument is going to be something that will be going on more and more campuses. There are some campuses where graduate students do where they
right.
are organized.
Right.
But I wonder if you think that more and more it's going to be something that more universities are going to have to come
yeah.
to grips with.
Yeah, I do. It hasn't come to any of my institutions yet, but I fully expect that it will, and I think it's an argument we're going to be seeing. I would say I think if one could step back just a bit from that argument, it's a classical American-style argument in which you define A and then B, and then you get into terrible arguments about whether it's A or B. And I suspect that somewhere the solution to this is to be found in recognizing that it's A and B, and that for graduate students, as for many other elements of the population, we're going to be moving more into a situation that I would describe as follows. I talked earlier about the growing importance of adult education. I think ultimately we're going to move into a world in which the following is simply assumed and taken for granted. You go through high school. When you leave high school, you do two things. You get a job and you enroll in a university. And you stay in both situations for the rest of your life. Maybe not the same job, the same university, but you fully expect that you're going to be going on through life working and educating yourself, that that's going to be essential to your success. And the case of graduate students who are being educated and educating themselves for careers that require a very high level of learning is really an example of that. It's not different from that.
If we are getting to a point where increasing numbers of people are going to be involved in higher education and something that they're going to continue to do through their life, how do we confront the issue of cost, which continues to go up every year? The tuition goes up. We, interestingly enough, here at this university, we are now experiencing something that we have never experienced before. We've got students who wish to go to school here on a wait list. And it's my understanding that people are starting to do people who might previously have gone to the elite private universities are starting to do cost-benefit analysis, and they're saying, you know,
yes,
U of I is not such a bad deal here. It's a heck of a lot cheaper than Harvard, and we're getting to the point where maybe the Harvard education is not significantly better, so more and more demand on universities like this. What do we do about the cost and the fact that there will still be a lot of people who could benefit by higher education who are priced out of the market?
Well, there are lots of aspects to that question. First, education, I think, since it ultimately comes down to interactions between scholars of both the senior and the junior kind. The senior scholars are the people we call professors. The junior scholars are those we call students. It is inherently going to be something that is very people intensive, and I doubt ever can be automatized or computerized or mechanized in a way that will substantially reduce costs. We are simply going to have to recognize that ongoing lifelong education is the cost of success for all of us. With respect to what's happening here at the University of Illinois, I don't think that's new. 15 years ago, when I was in Illinois, this institution was a very selective institution, and it was an institution that was hard to get into, and the price, the subsidized price, was very low. That's happening to more and more institutions around the country. In my own University of Maryland, College Park, 10 years ago, the average high school GPA of the entering freshman class was about 2.9-something. Last year, it was 3.7. And that's not due to grade inflation. That's due to people doing exactly what you described, recognizing that it's a hell of a good deal. Looking at the other coast, in the Bay Area of California, there's Berkeley, the University of California, Berkeley, a public institution, and there's Stanford University. And I've read somewhere recently that the mean family income of Berkeley students is higher than that of Stanford students. The rich kids go to the public institution, and the poorer kids go to the private institution. Both institutions of very high distinction.
Mm-hmm.
The dynamics are very, very interesting.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Donald Langenberg. He's chancellor of the University System of Maryland. Before that, was chancellor of the University of Illinois Chicago, has also served as acting director and deputy director of the National Science Foundation. He was a professor of physics at University of Pennsylvania. He's a physicist by his academic training. He's here to talk as part of a series looking at the university's changing role, sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study. And again, his talk is at 4 o'clock this afternoon, room 210 of the Illini Union, if you'd like to hear it. Questions are also welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here getting lined up on our toll-free line. The caller is in Chicago. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Uh-huh.
There's one area which I don't think you touched upon, and that is in the land-grant colleges, when they were originally designed them, so I understand, the intention was to have them serve as a place or organization for the general education of the citizenry, and that would be in the area of liberal arts generally, or general information, and you haven't touched upon that. How do you look at it now?
Well, first of all, obviously a firm grounding in what we often call the liberal arts and sciences is, in my view, simply an essential, a critical, central part of any and all educations. If I'm right about the need of all of us to continue educating ourselves throughout our lives, you've got to have a foundation for that. You've got to have some basis for it. And in my view, that's what a liberal education is all about. It's not peculiar to the land-grant universities. It's true of each and every institution of higher education. The land-grant universities have a special responsibility by statute and in the language of the Morrill Act to provide education in agriculture and the mechanic arts. It's the latter that we would today call engineering. And those were picked out because, if you remember when the Morrill Acts 1862 and 1890 were passed, the nation was undergoing a transition from an agrarian society to what we used to call the industrial age, when those were the critically important educational needs for a larger and larger fraction of the population. The creator of the Morrill Act idea referred to it as the education of the children of the industrial classes. And that very powerful notion is still very much alive today, and indeed as really at the root of the subject of this lecture series that I'm going to be participating in. We have become, the universities of the country have become absolutely essential to the new post-industrial age economy, which is based not so much on natural resources, the availability of iron ore, the availability of transportation, geographical location, but simply on the value of educated and skilled workers at all levels. Today, people come to where the jobs are. In the old days, people went to where the jobs were. Today, the jobs are coming to where the people are, the educated people are. We're still in the same business, but it's just got a different character than it used to have.
Well, what you say doesn't really direct itself to the notion that I've had, and that is the education of the, or the continuing education of the citizen for citizenship, and of course this is where the liberal arts notion comes in.
That's exactly right. Citizenship is lots of different things. It requires enough knowledge, for example, of what's happening in the new technology to be able to vote for and communicate with legislators who are going to be passing laws on all kinds of things, from stem cell research to Napster to what we do to promote the development of new industries. It requires having a sense of history. One of the things that I decry is that increasingly people in this country do not have a sense of where we have been. And I believe that if you don't know where you've been, you're going to have a terrible time figuring out where you are now, and an even worse time trying to figure out where to go next. So that's of critical importance.
But are the land-grant colleges concerning themselves?
Absolutely. Everyone I know is. Very much so.
Well, from I get from your talk,
during most of the program that basically they're looking, they're going into the professional area and staying away from this area that we're talking about now.
No, the area that we're talking about now is part and parcel of what most institutions call their general education requirement.
Yeah.
And that's been, and that's applicable to all students, regardless of what their major is, regardless of what field they choose to go into. And there again, I think our universities are beginning to pay even more attention than they used to ensuring the quality of that element of the curriculum.
Okay.
One more thing, and that's the area where you really run into resistance from the students themselves. As I get it, they generally want to be educated in the field that they originally go to college for, if they have a goal, and to hell with these crap courses, so-called.
Yeah, I'm afraid there is some of that. Quite understandably, students, whatever else happens to them in college, really want to be prepared to get a good job that will support a comfortable lifestyle. That's just simply a practical matter. It's one that applies to me, and I suspect most of our listeners today. But students are, in fact, attentive to and can be made attentive to the, shall I say, more general aspects of their education if they can be helped to understand that if they really are going to educate themselves and throughout their lives, they're going to have to do it themselves on some kind of foundation, and if they're going to be effective citizens, they're going to have very broad knowledge well outside a particular given career. They may wind up doing a certain kind of job when they get out, but nowadays people are beginning to understand that we're all going to have something like 8 to 10 jobs during our lives and maybe 3 or 4 totally different career areas, and we've simply got to be prepared for that.
Yeah. I appreciate the caller raising the issue, and because I think some people who have really who have looked at the whole concept of the land-grant college would suggest to us that, in fact, it did have those dual functions. That is, we mm-hmm. were training people to be workers, but there was this idea that we were also training people to be citizens. And I think some people would say that we have remembered the one and we have forgotten mm-hmm. the other.
Well, I think that's probably true. There are people with lots of different opinions about that, and sometimes they depend upon what your favorite subject in college was, other than your major. Yeah. But in my opinion, I think most institutions are very responsibly paying attention to that balance.
We must leave it there because we're here at the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from our guest. He'll be talking about Research Universities in the Third Millennium, Genius with Character. That's the title for his talk, part of the series on the university's changing role. He'll be talking today at 4 o'clock in the Alana Union, room 210, and anyone's welcome to attend. Our guest, Don Langenberg, is the Chancellor of the University System of Maryland. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure being here.